Speak up.
You're listening to Speak Up on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We're the campus and community radio station at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast from unceded Coast Salish territories.
Good morning. And welcome to CJSF. You're listening to Speak Up here on Monday, May 26th, 2025. Joining me in the studio, well, my name is Magnus Tiebold. I'm your host for the hour. And joining
Peter
me in the studio,
R.H.
Peter R.H. We got a bunch of stuff for you. We have an interview with Adrian Avendano of the Invasive Species Council of Metro Vancouver. And we're going to talk about invasive species and also about how you can get involved in helping to control them, because they have a whole bunch of programs on that. What are you going to talk about today, Peter?
Well, what I'm going to talk about is there was a UBC program called the Exploring of Concept of Progress in History.
Mm-hmm.
And it was interesting because no instructor supposedly engaged in philosophical discussion with your peers. So I thought that was an intriguing kind of thing. It wound up that it already happened. I was kind of hoping that I went to the professor at UBC about it. But you know how they have posters and it's already over? Have you seen that, Magnus, in your times around SFU and so on?
Yes.
So what I'm going to do is go what was not part of the course, which is about, interestingly enough, fire was utilized by the human race before the wheel. And actually it was, it was the one even before the we're Homo sapien, there is Neanderthal, and actually the one Homo erectus, that was the one that started controlling fire. The wheel's only about 6,000 years old. The people thought it was older. So I'm going to be talking a bit about that. That was sort of out of the sphere of the course outline. I'll go ahead. I got some of the person was funny. It sort of had an instructor in a way. And I was hoping, and supposedly the main student moderator is out of the country right now. I was hoping that she would. Now, the other thing is that the reason I'm doing that is because I was going to do today, if you've heard Guerrilla Radio, they slightly mention Burkina Faso amongst some other countries.
In West Africa.
Now, I was emailed a YouTube posting about this. But I talked, it was another person I know, and some of the information is not quite verified. And I actually, on Sunday, I did a lot of information on this, but I'm going to go to the consulate, hopefully be open this afternoon in downtown Vancouver. So I sort of kind of are changing the topic that I would have done, because I want to make sure that I got the information straight about this. So anyway, so I'm going to be talking about actually the fire and wheel and so on.
Wow, big topics. we also have, of course, Gardening with Embark. And we're going to be talking about getting your corn and pumpkins and squash into the ground, because it is the time for that. But we're going to start things off with a report from Danny, CJSF's Danny Nez Vadarani, about SFU research into indoor plant growing of both blueberry and raspberry crops. Of course, blueberry is a big money-earning agricultural crop here in BC, so we'll start off with that. And we will, and then we're going to head into our interview with Adrian Avendano of the Invasive Species Council of Metro Vancouver. Really interesting talk.
Reporting from Burnaby, BC, this is Danny Nesvadarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. A team of researchers at Simon Fraser University, led by Professor of Plant Functional Genomics, Jim Mattson, has successfully grown both blueberry and raspberry crops in the university's biotech greenhouse during the winter. This marks a major development in the team's research project, which has been working to identify the environmental conditions best for indoor blueberry and raspberry production. This project also aims to adapt the berries to the new environment through gene editing. CJSF recently took a trip down to the research team's lab, where Jim Mattson gave us a tour of not only the lab facilities, but the biotech greenhouse as well.
And this western red cedar was a very nice tree until a few years ago, and it died from repeated draw stress in the summer. And that's happening all over the campus. Western red cedar is quite drought sensitive. So that's the climate change. And it's actually well on the way for agriculture too, that you need to adjust varieties based on climate change.
So this is the greenhouse. Always quite messy. And also quite hot. Let's see how hot it is.
For the next year, do you foresee this just improving and getting better?
Yes, but we're not doing it here. We're doing it primarily in Chilliwack, and where we have a larger greenhouse. It's highly controlled. We measure all the inputs. We measure the amount of electricity, the amount of natural gas used for heating, and so on, to find out a good compromise, I should say, between growth and cost of producing. So in the end, it's not just science. You have to make it commercially feasible too. Otherwise, it's not going to be used by anyone, so to say.
Another question we had for Mattson was, what was contributing to this project's success? Why were they seeing progress in indoor berry growing that hadn't been seen before?
I think the gene editing is a big part, because it's really hard to change in a short time traits in perennial species in particular. They take years to... It usually takes something like 10 to 20 years to make a new variety, and the changes are usually incremental. And blueberry in particular is really hard, because it has four copies of each gene. And for some traits, you need to knock out not just one copy, but all four. And that can never be done, it's very difficult to do that by traditional breeding, especially since no one knows what gene to look at that happens. So we can do it in a controlled way without changing anything else in the genome, just changing that gene. So that's a big change. There's a revolution, I think, in agriculture, the gene editing. They will not... So transgenics are highly controversial, even though it has been shown that it is safe and it's too expensive. So it's only the big companies that can pursue them right now. It costs many, many millions, actually tens of millions, to get new varieties approved that are transgenic. So this is sort of the opportunity for breeders of all breeds and species to do something. So it's quite a change. It's not just the big crops like maize and rice and wheat. It's other crops that can be bred in a fairly short time for particular traits without changing the whole genome, so to say, mixing up the whole genome. So that's a big change.
He then went on to explain the mechanisms behind the berry growing process.
So we did a test this winter with both... raspberry and blueberry, primarily blueberry, but raspberry as well, and it worked out surprisingly well. So blueberry, normally they make the flower buds in the late summer, when days are getting shorter and the nights are getting cooler. Then the plant get the signal that it's time to make flower buds, but then they go dormant from the same treatments. When it gets cooler and shorter day, after a while they go dormant, and then they stay dormant until the spring, until about March, April, when the longer days and warmer temperatures make them wake up and start growing again. So the problem is, if you then want to grow them in winter time, you want to induce flower bud formation, but you do not want them to go dormant. Because if they go dormant, they're going to stay. It doesn't matter if you put light on them and high temperature. They're not going to do anything for a few months. So they need a specific time of cold treatment before they start growing again. But if you time it correctly, you can induce flower buds, but they do not go dormant. And that's what we did with the blueberry in the fall. So we took them inside before they went dormant, and then they started growing in. The first one already in September, and we had the first crop in December, with the peak of the crop in January and February.
During our conversation, Mattson also stressed the potential that this project has to progress Canada's domestic agriculture.
Well, we got a grant from the Weston Family Foundation, which is tied, of course, to the Loblaws and so on. They are the owners. Weston is the owners of Loblaws and so on. And what happened a few years ago during COVID, there was problems with import because of the COVID crisis. And this company and other companies and consumers realized that, hey, there can be big disruptions in import of produce, including berries, not just berries, but other too, during events of COVID. And of course now with Trump and his activities, then it's entirely possible that these things will be more expensive too. So it's good to have a domestic production.
Well, there is still much more work that needs to be done to make these berries viable for commercial production. Jim Mattson and his research team are optimistic of the project's future outcomes. Once again, this has been Danny Nezvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not have been possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative.
Thank you to Danny for that report. Excuse me. We have, in just a couple of moments, we have our interview with the Invasive Species Council of Metro Vancouver, but first, it is time for Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. I'm Dara Miles Wilson. Grief settles in the body like an overcast sky on a windless day. Heavy, unmoving. At least that's how it felt on the day of my cousin's funeral. On that June morning in Camden, South Carolina, the world felt hushed, aside from my family's tears. Our collective grief colored everything in lackluster gray. Well, almost everything. Shortly after the procession began escorting my cousin to his final resting place, I spotted a flash of vermilion. A red-headed woodpecker appeared mere yards away from me, the first one I had ever seen with my own eyes, or what birders call a lifer. Its vibrant colors were a bright spot on an otherwise dark day. Later, while I walked in the woods on my uncle's property at twilight, an eastern whippoorwill called out from the trees, steadfast and distinct, right as dusk thickened into night. Another lifer, another extraordinary gift. I didn't expect to find joy as I wandered in the wilderness that evening. But joy, as it turns out, appears before us in the most unexpected places at unpredictable times. As I remember my cousin, I hold tightly to this message from the birds I saw. Joy does not wait. It simply arrives, even in the midst of sorrow. For Bird Note, I'm Dara Miles Wilson.
Adrian Evan Danio is the executive director of the Invasive Species Council of Greater Vancouver. You know, in this modern world with so much travel, in every form, trucks going everywhere, people transporting boats, people bringing special exotic plants in. Invasive species are a significant issue and a risk to the natural species of our habitat. I talked to Adrian from the ISCMV.
Did she mention the feral pigs, Magnus?
Hmm?
There's as many these feral pigs in Texas as there are people in Vancouver?
We did not talk about that, and you'll be pleased to know that this conversation is all about invasive species right here in our region.
Okay.
Not talking about problems
well,
elsewhere.
Well, Vancouver Island, a golf course, was... I'll say a few moments after this about the feral pigs, okay?
Perfect. Yeah, so I talked to Adrian just last week, and listen to this report, because not only will you learn a bit about invasive species here in Vancouver, but also how you can get involved in helping to control and mitigate the problems of invasive species. Here's my conversation with Adrian. Joining me now is Adrian Avendano from the Invasive Species Council of Metro Vancouver. And as the organization's name makes clear, you're all about dealing with invasive species. So, well, first off, welcome. Thanks for joining the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Magnus, for the invitation.
Yeah, what are invasive species and why should we care about them?
That's a really good question. So essentially, invasive species are any species from one part of the world that then get introduced to a different part of the world. And in the new area in which they are established, they have significant negative effects on the landscape for a variety of reasons.
Right.
And so there are lots of organisms that are constantly in flux from one place to the other. However, there's a subset of these organisms that when they do arrive in a new area, through a variety of different reasons, they can cause a whole laundry list of different negative impacts.
How much of a problem is that in Vancouver and I guess in British Columbia in general?
So I can't necessarily speak about the direct impact, say like on a provincial wide, like in terms of like a specific metric of like how much this is impacting. But I will say that on a global scale, invasive species are the second greatest threat to biodiversity worldwide. And so essentially invasive species are, a significant issue everywhere. And in the specific context of British Columbia, like we have, over like at least 120 different species that are recognized as being invasive, and a lot of them are being managed in different contexts across the province.
Right. What are the ways in which in invasive species cause problems?
So generally we can think about more or less three general areas that invasive species can impact us. So first of all, there are environmental impacts, then there are health, social, and cultural impacts, and of course, economic impacts. And so specifically, like beginning in the environmental impacts, it really depends on the species in question that we're kind of referring to. However, there are just some general characteristics of these species that that kind of create these negative impacts. And so it can range everything from taking up physical space in an area. So what happens a lot with invasive species, especially plants, is that they can create monocultures in natural areas or areas that aren't actively managed by human beings. And that isn't great because it creates a loss in biodiversity, and the loss in biodiversity creates imbalances in specific types of ecosystems. And this can affect native species to an area significantly, depending on which, where they are occurring. That's one example, of course, that they're able to change soil chemistry in environments. They can facilitate significant erosion in different environments. A lot of invasive species are fire hazards. And so in the light of the current climate crisis and climate change, it exacerbates these impacts even further. And it really just depends on what species we're talking about and where it's, where they are established. But those are kind of like the environmental impacts. From a health and social cultural perspective, invasive species can cause harm to human health and to wildlife health. So a lot of invasive species are toxic either to ingest or being touched by specific species. So the most common example of this is giant hogweed, which has a photoactive sap, and it also has little like hairs on the leaves and on the stems that if you get close to this plant and you're in contact direct contact with it without any protection, and then you're exposed to sunlight, it creates a chemical reaction that causes really severe lesioning and bruises and burns.
Well, I haven't even heard of that plant.
Yeah. So, and then a lot of them are, you know, just toxic to ingest, for example. So poison hemlock is another one that's highly monitored in the province. And if you eat 6 to 7 leaves, it can be a fatal dose. And of course, this, you know, this goes across the board with other wildlife as well, right. People's pets and the like. And continuing on the health and social cultural aspect, a lot of invasive species can cause damage to infrastructure. So in all types of infrastructure, whether it's transport routes or any activities regarding industrial activities. So in all of the major industries. And as well, there's significant loss to traditional foods and medicines for indigenous communities in the province and across across the world and where they occur. And finally, from an economic perspective as well, the impacts are wide ranged, but they basically impact most of the industrial activity that humans partake in our current society. So from agriculture, farmers can have reduced yields and increased costs to produce their crops. There can be livestock that can be poisoned as a result of having invasive species in around grazing lands. In forestry, it can again reduce yields and also make reforestation efforts really difficult because they take up so much physical space, and so cut blocks are much more difficult to manage. And even things like recreation and tourism. So the impact of invasive species can either close down national parks or decrease access to specific areas. And this recently has happened with the detection of it's an invasive species, but it's a freshwater fish disease called whirling disease. It's a virus. And so currently Yoho National Park is closed because they're quarantining the water body that has been detected to have whirling disease. And so as a result, you know, of course, there people aren't working in the park, you know, so there's jobs losses and, you know, less traffic in areas. So, yeah, you can kind of see the different implications.
And people are probably familiar with things like Eurasian milfoil clogging and reducing the recreation possibilities of lakes and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, absolutely.
We live in a world where there's lots of movement. People are coming and going. And how did the invasive species get here?
Yeah. So, I mean, so that's kind of the main point, and that's the main way that invasive species are able to get around throughout the world is that it's through human activity, right? And so currently in our globalized society in which we live, there's immense amount of material that is transported from one place to another and through all variety of means. You know, from a physical standpoint, invasive species can be carried by land, by wind, by water, by both like natural ways. So as in like, for example, a bird will eat the fruit of an invasive species, the bird flies away. The fruit that the bird ingested goes through its digestive system. It lays its dropping in, who knows, like kilometers away. Right. That plant then propagates, right? And then this kind of continues more on kind of like the modern context, like a lot of invasive species are brought in, on transportation vehicles, so boats, trains, cars, even simple things. Like, for example, if people go out to a hike and maybe they're going off trail for a moment, maybe there's some invasive species material on the grounds in which they're going, and then they leave the park. They don't clean their boots, and then they go to another area. And so that could be a vector of transmission as well. Anything related to the transport of like natural materials. So everything from soil to the plants themselves. The list is quite long.
So really, so many different ways. So the Invasive Species Council of Metro Vancouver, you're focused on this issue. Tell me about mm-hmm. what the mission of the Invasive Species Council is.
Yeah, so essentially our mission is to provide locally sourced and research around best management practices for regionally important invasive species. And as well, we're currently working towards this through our different education and outreach programs. We work with our local governments in our region, and as well different nonprofit organizations and some branches of the federal government in conjunction with these projects. And so the biggest thing that we offer is our best management practice guides and our fact sheets that are available free for access on our website. And we also run lots of different community events. So right now we're kind of in the peak season of doing community stewardship events. So we currently are doing this in Burnaby, in New West, and Delta.
And this is an opportunity for people to get involved, like people listening now and anyone who's interested in the issue.
That's right. Yeah. So essentially we're in different parks where there are presences of different invasive plants. And so we meet up, and for a few hours we're weeding between, you know, kind of the spring and early fall, and then in the later fall season we're revegetating with different native plants. And alongside this, I do a lot of presentations to different groups all across the region. So anywhere from, you know, university classes to garden clubs to public libraries, speaking about the issues that we're talking about today.
So I know your invasive species pulls happen quite often. You're partnering with Burnaby, I think New West and Delta, at the very least, for regular events. I think the Burnaby events, there's something happening every week.
Yeah, there was, more or less, like now we're kind of like, if it's not every week, maybe every other week. And we're in three different areas this year. So Burnaby Mountain, which we started kind of like at the trailhead of, on Centennial Road, I believe. And then we're in Central Park. So that's been the big project for the past 3 or 4 years. And then we're in Deer Lake Park and Burnaby Lake Park as well.
And how do people get involved with that or the other community events? Is the information on your website?
Yeah, so all of our events are listed on our website. We have an events page, and it basically just scrolls through all the things that are going on. I will say that our events page also includes events that aren't necessarily run by the Invasive Species Council of Metro Vancouver, but they are run by our community partners in some shape, way, or form.
So I know, for instance, if people here in Burnaby are interested, they can look on the Burnaby City of Burnaby website for the Burnaby Community Stewardship, I think is the name of the program that runs these, and they can find, and there's a way to sign up there and stuff. I imagine it's kind of a, you know, I mean, you're out there doing good work, but it's probably, you know, a bit of a fun social activities too, with a group of folks and like-minded individuals and stuff.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And that's kind of the biggest like draw for people and also for us to facilitate these events, because it is more than just doing the work on the ground. It's really a way for people to come together and to learn from one another and from the areas in which we work. Absolutely.
Yeah. From what I understand, you also have a way of that people can report where they find invasive species, so that this can be tracked. Can you tell me a bit about that?
Absolutely. So all the reporting that that is available for folks to do is actually through different. There are a few different ways. The first one is, and probably the most important one, is through the Report Invasive BC app. And so this is actually the provincial database that people are submitting to. And so that would be my first recommendation, because it kind of goes directly to the folks at the province. And so in the context of our of BC, a lot of the invasive species management is administered through the provincial government, through the Ministry of Forests. And so currently there are a bunch of different staff who are invasive species specialists. And essentially every report that they receive through the Report Invasives BC app goes directly to the corresponding specialist. And so this is important, because there are certain species that have a higher priority for management and containment. And so any reports being submitted through this platform will get a direct response from said individual.
And what's that app called again, so people can look for it?
It's the Report Invasives BC, and it's it can be found on Android and Apple devices, and there's also an online web page through the province of BC as well.
But obviously the app's going to be great, because you can you see it, you can put that information right in.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's pretty straightforward. It's it takes a photo, you can take a photo, and it'll share the coordinates, and you can make any additional notes. And there's kind of the list of all the species as well, so you can kind of get an idea if you're not sure what it, things may be. But definitely, I recommend folks to to understand maybe some basic characteristics of some invasives, because it won't tell you exactly what it is. It's just more like if you know what it is, you can report it.
Okay, that's great. Well, it sounds like there's lots of ways people can get involved. I mean, this is an issue, you know, we hear about in the news from time to time, and I'm not sure we always understand just how important it is. But through, you know, things like the app and the programs you're running and the information on your website, there's lots of ways people can contribute.
Absolutely. Yeah, and one thing for, that we definitely want to encourage is for folks to just be able to gain a curiosity about the environment in which we live, right?
Yeah.
And we do this because there are so many incredible native species in our area, and we're actually really privileged to have access to natural spaces where we actually do see the majority of, for example, native species, and that's something that we're incredibly proud of, and is something that we can try to maintain through all these different initiatives.
Great. Well, tell me about how people can access the resources on your website.
Yeah. So you can find us at iscmv.ca, and essentially there are a bunch of different tabs on the left side of the homepage. And whatever you're particularly interested in, you can take a look and click on one of these pages, and it will just send you to a specific site where it will then kind of lay out exactly what it is that we offer. And so, and also there's a button on the bottom of the homepage where you can sign up for our newsletter. So we kind of do like a bit of a quarterly newsletter, and this kind of it gives a summary of like what we've been up to and also promote the events that we're running. And also we'd like to share some relevant news regarding invasive species, particularly to Metro Vancouver and the province.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Adrian Avendano, from the Invasive Species Council of Metro Vancouver. Lots of information on that on their website, which is iscmv.ca. And there are a lot of programs you can, if you're listening, interested in this issue, of course, you can read up more from their website, but also get involved with some of the programs, like the ones, collaborations with City of Burnaby, New West, Delta, and other organizations. More information on the city websites, but also the ISCMV website as well. Thank you so much for joining me, Adrian Avendano.
No, thank you, Angus. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you.
And enjoy your summer out pulling up those invasive species.
Oh, yeah. We'll do our best.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining me. All right. And if you're interested in, we talked a bit about it in the interview, but if you're interested in helping out there, the ISCMV runs a number of programs in collaboration with area municipalities and other organizations here in Burnaby. There's the Burnaby Environmental Stewardship, and they have events, I think, every other weekend, maybe even more frequently, often up here on Burnaby Mountain and in Deer Lake and other places. You can find out more about those programs from the Burnaby City of Burnaby website. Just search for Burnaby Environmental Stewardship. You can find about some of the other programs on the ISCMV website. And, you know, it's not only a chance to help out your community, but also get out with some other like-minded folks and maybe make some new friends.
Okay. Now, I don't usually watch W5, but this...
those of you who don't, W5 is a investigative journalism program.
CTV is almost as old as I am.
Yep.
I'm a bit older than W5 anyway.
Yep.
Anyway, this was about 3 years ago. So what it's called the feral pig. Now, this is what happened. Farmers in Canada and the United States wanted to create a better pig. So they took, like, kind of the ordinary farm pig, and they took, like, a boar, and they bred it. But what they didn't know what was going to happen was they were going to invent a smarter pig, a pig bigger, stronger and smarter that knew they were going to be slaughtered. So they escaped. And actually, there's as many of these feral pigs in Texas as there are people in Vancouver, supposedly. From that report, I guess we in the metro Vancouver area have been spared this. However, a Vancouver Island golf course hasn't, which means it must have been a farmer created to try to do the pigs and they escaped. Because I don't think they could swim very well, but anyway, no. It's actually in the report. One person said I tried to tell people about it was a scientist or whatever, and he said I tried to tell people about this 10 years ago. We could have got rid of them, and he said they're going to last at least 1,000 years. And what happens is that the parents teach the children how to avoid bullets or how the best way. So they have been shooting them in helicopters. Like you're in the helicopter shooting at them, and they only get about half of them, supposedly.
They've learned how to sort of hide from the helicopters.
So go to the internet and just put feral pig, and you'll get a lot of things on it. But fortunately, I guess, in this metro Vancouver area, we've been spared this, mm-hmm. unlike the Vancouver Island golf course. Yep. But I had to say about this, because he didn't say one thing about it.
All right. Next up, we have Gardening with Embark. And we'll be talking... Well, I'll leave it with that for you. And then we'll be back with Peter for the end of the show. Welcome to Gardening with Embark. Joining me in the studio today, as every week, is Pablo Vimas, Gardens Manager for Embark Sustainability Society here at SFU. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
I believe it is week 21.
Correct, 21. Yes, and a strange week. It started very cold. Mm-hmm. Monday was very, very cold. Over the weekend, we had hail and heavy rain here on Burnaby Mountain.
Yeah.
So it was like, oh, and Monday very cold. And yesterday and today, the weather decided to warm up. And it seems that we're heading into a
warm stretch.
That's right. Last week we talked about start the summer gardening.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the crops that we always plant over the summer is corn.
Right.
Well, who doesn't like corn?
Yeah.
So there are different varieties of corn, including the popcorn, which is a type of corn.
Yeah.
And then we have the yellow peach corn, the sweet corn, white corn, yellow corn, pink corn, purple corn.
Yeah.
Either for consumption or for decoration, if you want to have popcorn for corn for decoration. So this is the time to start planting. Corn is we can grow only once a year. It's a crop that requires lots of sunlight and good weather. So how we start here in our gardens, we have garden beds 4 feet by 4 feet.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole garden bed is covered with corn.
Right.
We plant 4 corns per square.
Per square foot?
Per square foot.
Right.
Yeah. So it's a decent amount of corn. So we're having about 16 squares, so the times 4, 6. Yeah, you make the math and then how many corns we have. We usually put 2 seeds,
mm-hmm.
and when one of the seeds have germinated, we trim the weak one, so leaving one big stalk in there.
That just sort of gives you some extra insurance to make sure you got something for every spot.
Correct. So with corn, we can pre-soak overnight,
mm-hmm.
so to encourage the water to go inside the seed and start to the germination process. But sometimes one of the seeds is dead. So in order to secure that we have a plant in the spot, we put 2 seeds.
Right.
And we put around 2 to 3 inches deep. Yeah, so that's where the corn. And
how long does it take once you put the seeds in? How long before you're going to start seeing a shoot?
Well, it's around 13 weeks since before we can see any corn.
Oh, really?
Yes. So
it's like even before the shoot comes up.
When shoot comes out is a week.
Oh, okay.
A week, seven days. Yeah.
After a week or so, that's when we're looking to make that choice.
Yeah.
Go with the strongest.
Yeah. So after 15 days, we should have all the germinated seeds, and then you can do the choice to trim one and leave the other there. The world crop lasts for 13 weeks,
mm-hmm.
and so that's why
that brings us to about the end of August.
Correct. Yep. So beginning of September. So.
Yeah.
So when the weather just starts turning to cold, and yeah, so that's with corn.
And once they once the corn's there, how long does it start producing? Is it one big rush of ears that you get, or does?
Oh yeah, so we get just, well, the ears you can have up to four. Mm-hmm. If there's a good variety.
Yeah.
The ears you will be harvesting from the bottom, close to the ground up.
Yeah.
And how you know that it is ready to harvest is when you touch, when the silks are brown,
mm-hmm.
and then you will try to fill the kernels through the husk.
Right.
Or you can just break a little bit of the husk and see how the kernels are.
Yeah.
And then you can pinch one of the kernels. If a white liquid is coming, it's not ready yet.
Yeah.
But if a milky liquid is coming, the corn is ready to eat as a fresh corn.
Right.
If we want to wait till have a completely hard corn, we have to wait till the plant dies.
So that's when it's sort of hard and like dried out.
Dried out, yeah. So that would be, for instance, for the popcorn. The popcorn, we need a mature ear. We don't need a milky one. Yes.
Okay. So when you do that, the popcorn, A, is it a specific variety, and B, can you actually, you know, take the kernels off and pop it?
when the corn is completely dry, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
When it's in a milky state, no. You could consume as a fresh corn, but it will be a bit chewy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Corn has some diseases too.
Yeah.
We have the main fungi growing sometimes in the corn, in the ear, mm-hmm. corn ear itself. And the other is the yellow. The leaves can be with some rust, a yellow fungi growing in there as well. Here in our garden, sometimes it shows up, sometimes it doesn't. So since it's a small plot and we are just for fun as well growing, mm-hmm. so we don't care much about that. Sometimes we have aphids here, and we have wasps.
Mm-hmm.
Just they are in the corn because of the aphids secreting this honeydew, and wasps are attracted. So we have wasps. So far, nothing has happened. Nobody got stung. But yeah, you might see some wasps just hanging around because of all this honeydew.
And then the other thing we're looking at growing, or putting in the ground now, which also comes up around the end of the summer, is pumpkins and other sort of squash.
That's right. So what we call the winter squashes.
Yeah.
They're called winter squash because fruits are ready for consumption over the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why. So we have the pumpkins, the peanut, the butternut squash, acorn squash. So those are what we consume over the winter. So this is a time to plant as well. If you have heard before, we have the three sisters, beans, corn, and squashes all grown together.
Yeah.
In this case, we are talking about growing separately.
Mm-hmm.
And so, because of the how our boxes are. So we can plant squashes, being pumpkins or acorn or butternut squash. We plant one squash per 2 square feet.
Yeah.
So one squash for 2 square feet. So in our garden base, 4 feet by 4 feet, we can plant up to 2 plants in that space.
Right.
Yeah. Then it's up to us if we would like just them to let them run, spread themselves, or we can create a trellis. We train the plant to climb the trellis. So that's in order to go vertical.
Yeah.
But as squashes are known in the three sisters, is the running sister, the running away sister.
Yeah.
It just goes all over the place. There is no way to keep it controlled. It climbs fences.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But I like to have it more like in our garden, just covered in the ground, which is quite nice. Yeah. Again, the seeds are covered with a very strong husk. So if you ever have eaten pumpkin seeds, you see mm-hmm. how difficult sometimes it is just to take the seed coat. So what we can do is just do a small trim at the end of the seed, at the base of the seed, in order to allow the water to get inside the seed and kicking the germination process. So after that, in a week time, seeds will germinate.
Yep.
pumpkin doesn't like to be transplanted. Mm-hmm. Somehow has a taproot that doesn't like to be disturbed.
Right.
So what some tricks have come is sometimes we have these strawberry baskets with a kind of a meshy system. It's a meshy strawberry basket. Plant in there and the walls basket goes into the ground.
Right.
So now we can use as well paper pots, which will dissolve in once we transport. So they don't like to be transplanted. So you have to plant straight in the ground.
Right.
And then, yeah, again, 130 days to wait. So we're talking about 17 weeks for having a pumpkin. If we are going to consume over the winter, we need to wait that the pumpkin matures on the vine. Yeah. When we harvest, we have to make sure that there is at least 2 inches of vine from the pumpkin itself or from the gourd itself.
Yeah.
So don't cut the vine close to the fruit.
Right.
We need to leave a little tail at the end.
And this applies to the pumpkin and the other squash?
And the other squashes, yeah. So don't, because somehow as the plant, as the fruit matures and is stored, this little stump of the vine starts to shrinkle and prevent any disease for the fruit.
Right.
Yeah, so that's one thing. The other is you can plant the seeds, put the seeds 2 inches deep.
Yeah.
So the corn is 2 to 3 for the squash, 2 seeds, 2 inches deep. And yeah, every time we wait around a week for see how it germinate.
Yeah.
The squash have, when we see the plant mature, we have this disease called the white mildew, which is a powdery mildew, powdery covering the leaves of the squash. That is when plants start getting old, or the when we water the leaves of the squash.
Oh, okay.
That is another thing that shows up when we are so happy spraying the leaves with water, mildew will show up.
Right. So again, as we've talked about before, water the soil, not the plant.
Yeah. Again, so kind of if we want to delay the showing up of the white powdery mildew, water the soil.
Yeah.
And so this disease will show up when the plant is old. As well, with squash, remove any dead leaf, remove any sick leaf, or remove any yellow leaf. So it's just from using a scissors or a pruners, you can just cut the leaves and leave the stem alone. Yeah. So that's with pumpkin. And
great.
Well, by October, we should have lots of pumpkin and squashes and ready for making pumpkin pie and all of the delicious stuff for pumpkins. Yeah.
Excellent. One thing, I think maybe I moved you away from the corn too quickly, but you do have to help with the pollination of corn, right?
Yes. Yes, as we have talked before, all the grasses pollinate through wind.
Yeah.
So the corn is a grass, a type of grass. So we need to help. So what we can do is to cut the tassels with a scissors when they are nice and open, and you can see the stems holding the pollen. You just can cut it and shake it on top of the silks, hopefully that you help to pollinate. Yeah. So there's another fun thing to do in the garden if you if you have some extra time. Yeah, help the plant to get fertilized and have nice corn.
Excellent. All right, corn and squash and pumpkins in the garden now, and you'll have your bounty come the fall.
That's right. Yeah. So we are thinking harvesting for the fall.
Well, I guess as a gardener, you're always thinking ahead, right?
Yes, and I hope that the weather really warms up. And so both crops, squash and corn, they need to be watered when there is a dry spell, a period that we don't have any rainfall. So we need to water. And when we have rain, like over the weekend, we have to wait 48 hours before I start thinking to water.
Right.
Yeah, so it had rain, so yesterday was good, today is good. I will be planning to water over the weekend.
Great. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you, Pablo, for joining us and helping us get our corn and squash and whatnot in the garden.
Happy to be here and happy to share all these little tips and experience that we have here at SFU.
Great. Pablo Vimas of Embark Sustainability Society. How do we find out more about Embark?
Embark is based in the Studio Union building, the first floor. You can look at our website, embarksustainability.org, and follow our social media channels at Embar Sustainability.
Excellent. Thanks so much. See you next week.
See you next week.
And despite the weather, what it looks like out there right now here in Vancouver and the lower mainland, the weather is going to be trending towards a little nicer as the week goes on. Chances of showers today, highs to 18, but then it's warming up with by Wednesday. It's going to be clear and sunny with highs up to 24. A little rain on Thursday and then back to sun for the weekend. So that's our forecast for this weekend. If you want to comment on anything you hear here on CJSF or on this program, you can send us a text right here in the studio at 778-782-2573. That's 778-782-CJSF. And we'd love to hear from you about anything you hear on Speak Up any day of the week or any of our other programs. Or maybe you have some information you want to pass along that you hope we can share with our listeners. All that is great. So give us a message. You can also call us in the studio. But, you know, when we're doing a show like this, we can't really pick up in the middle of things necessarily. Although if you call the music shows, they love to hear from you. So do that instead. Once again, that number is 778-782-2573, 782-CJSF. Give us a call. Give us a text. Let us know what you think. Peter.
Yeah, anyway, so I had a bit of change in plan because I have to verify some information I was doing. Anyway, it was here was the name of it. It was Philosophy at UBC, Exploring the Concept of Progress in History. And it said no instructor earned 3 credits. And I thought that was intriguing, but then, of course, it had already happened. And there was quite a few of these damn posters. But I was able to meet with the person who had conducted it, and I got a reading list of it.
What's the course called?
Exploring the Concept of Progress in History.
Okay.
That's the name of it.
Yeah.
And so as he gave me a reading list, the person, they got a student to head it. I think he's out in Ontario or something. Hopefully we can, in future, I'll be able to contact him. One thing, it kind of starts out with the ancient Greece. So part of the reading list is 1973 E.R. Dobbs, and 1973 essay, The Ancient Concept of Progress and Other Essays on Greek Literature and Belief. And there's something else from 2009, The Evolution of Darwinism. So they had Darwinism and Evolutionary Progress, and is evolution progressive? Now, maybe they're just talking about the concept of it, how it was brought into society.
Mm-hmm.
But what I like to do is sort of seems out of the sphere of this course. And it's interesting that you would think that the wheel was invented prior to a fire being part of fire being mm-hmm. controlled. Now, interestingly, fire is even beyond ours, before our species. We're Homo sapien, mm-hmm. then there's Neanderthal, and there's Homo erectus. Homo erectus was actually, that's about 2 million years ago, probably from lightning or something, they started controlling fire. And then about 50,000 years ago, like the Neanderthals, they're, I always think, you know, with the cliches, the two sticks of wood, right, inducing a fire, but it was actually by stone first.
Mm-hmm.
So the human species had fire, but they weren't able to artificially induce it.
Right.
But the other thing is that you would have, even the artificial inducement of fire is prior to the wheel. And the wheel, in fact, you know, there's that show Quirks and Quarks
mm-hmm.
on yep. the competition.
Yeah, CBC, on the CBC.
CBC Radio. They did a report on it. I was a bit surprised, too, because it wasn't really what I think about a lot. But I said, oh, that's interesting. Yeah. So what it is that the wheel seemed, which is actually, it's sometimes you got to you need the sprocket or
the axle.
The axle, that's an important concept in it. Like but the Egyptians had rolling logs, mm-hmm. but that's really not quite the thing.
Well, you can imagine the big difficulty. I mean, I'm sure people understood the idea that round things roll, and some, you know, and then you would use logs or similar things to transport heavy over short distances. But you can see the sort of challenge of figuring out how to make an axle, and then you got to lubricate it because, of course, the axle and the wheel are spinning, but the cart or whatever is not, and creating something that actually works and doesn't wear away in almost no time at all.
But how they're proposing that it was invented, you would have thought that copper mining is a bit more of a kind of elaborate thing than the wheel. But supposedly it came forth because in sort of the Eastern European era going towards the Middle East, that's where they did some copper mining. And they were dragging, like, mm-hmm. the cate of the, you know, they would go in, get the copper, put it in the box, and dragging it. And they said, well, why don't, I think maybe a wheel thing would kind of work. But the thing is, you would think mining is much more of an elaborate concept than a wheel. But I guess it's hard to get things round.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, with the mining, you're sort of digging and... You know, it's sort of an extension of things you're already doing. I mean, if you're going underground a bit, which you might, then you start figuring out ways to sort of prop up your holes so it doesn't collapse on you. Although I bet that happened a lot. But you're still just using the technologies that some sort of shovel device and some sort of pick device. I'm assuming, you know, the earliest mines probably wouldn't have, you know, would have been going through softer material to get to wherever the ore was. And then you drag it out, and then that's a whole different process of melting it down.
So the ancient Greeks, because mm-hmm. it was around 3,500, 3,000, 3,050 BC. So the ancient Greek civilization kind of inherited that. And so it's interesting that arguably Western civilization starts but with Homer, which is about 800 BC, I think.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting that they inherited a few things. What happened, supposedly, there was a thriving, in the Mediterranean Sea area, a thriving trading thing, and it collapsed prior mm-hmm. to... Homer and the ancient Greeks.
Yeah, I mean, we don't really have time to get into it, but it's sort of, I've read a bunch about it, you know, and they talk about the sea peoples who were like the Phoenicians and I guess were, you know, moving around in boats and I don't know, disrupted the trade. And I think part of the issue is that, you know, that was sort of the Bronze Age. And the problem with bronze, because the Bronze Age happens and then it's the Iron Age, right? But the problem with bronze is to make bronze from copper, you need tin, and tin is very rare in that part of the world. So that might have been part of it. But because there's not a lot of documentation available, they're still not really clear from what all I've read about why that Bronze Age collapse happened.
But the main point is that a lot of it got lost, and we have the, like Homer does a type of pseudo-historian thing.
Yeah.
And also ones after Homer. And so it's sort of thought that a lot of that was forgotten but kind of revived a mm-hmm. bit. But so Western civilization sort of inherited the wheel, which is a major thing. Now, you know that Charles Schulz said the hardest thing about drawing peanuts was drawing Charlie Brown's round head. So there you go. It's not so – and they said Leonardo Leonardo da Vinci was able to draw a perfect circle. So he had some chalk, and they knew he had come by because he drew a perfect circle.
Right.
So maybe that's why it took a while to invent it.
Well, getting things perfectly round is not easy.
Yeah.
All right. We are almost out of time here at Speak Up. Democracy Now! Is coming up in 30 seconds. And after that, there will be Wandering Rhythms with Nick Legacy. and a lot more great programming coming up here on CJSF. I'm going to let Hallelujah Halu play us out here. She's a local musician. Check her out. She's really great.